Rabbi, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, Doug?
Very good, thanks.
Hi, Rabbi. This is Terry Schneeweiss.
Terry, how are you?
I'm fine.
It's been a while since...
And two of them are still there.
Good to hear.
Got Johnny up there now.
Good to hear. You haven't
seen... I'll be there more often next year when Johnny is living there.
But he's going to be going to the
Don't
dorm.
Tell him I said so.
I promise not to. And how's Matt? Matt's doing good?
That's doing right. Thank you very much. And Dan would be here, but he's working. He's on call all day today, so.
Okay, what does he do?
He's an anesthesiologist.
You have to sleep.
Yeah, but more importantly, you should wake them up.
Very good.
Thank you for having me participate, by the way.
Sure, whenever you can. We're doing this every Sunday.
Great, thank you.
And we'll just start in a moment because I told people we'd start 3, so I'll give them another minute to get online. I guess you have a couple of people that are calling in, Doug.
Yeah, we are expecting a couple more. Okay. Rabbi, are you using a headset?
No, I'm not. Using a speakerphone.
Okay, is there any way you can turn up your volume a little bit?
I don't think I have that control.
Can I put it on speakerphone for myself, or should I just hold it?
No, you can do speakerphone.
Oh, hi, Cal.
Hi.
Doug, how was the sound yesterday's class?
Oh, that was good.
All right, I'm going to be using the exact same setup.
Okay. Thank you. Someone else just joined?
Yeah, Brad, Mary, ready.
Brad and Mary.
Brad, thanks for the sources. Good sources, Brad.
But I'll take the credit. I mean, you know, there's nothing in my pride that will prevent me from doing that.
No. And that's okay, Grant. Good, you got the audio. And okay, so let's start. Seems to be the audio is fine now. So, again, the topic that we're discussing is, and again, Doug, if the sound doesn't sound good at a certain point, just you know, speak up. I'm gonna try and hold it as close as I can, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
How is it right here? Is that all right?
That's real good, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so again, the topic is Judaism versus other religions. So let's start out with a question. What is the objective of religion? Again, like anytime you start a discourse, so it's important to define your terms before you start defining how those terms relate to concepts. So the first question would be is how do we define the objective of religion? Input, feel free to type in the screen. And Doug and Mary, Brad, Cal, feel free to speak up. All right, so that's the first question. What is the objective of religion?
Would it be to find out the truth about our origins and the Creator?
Okay, good. That's an important word, truth. To find out truth about, again, because religion, if you define religion, it cannot be discussed outside of a relationship between man and God. So it would be, like you're saying, to find out the truth regarding our relationship to God and His will for man. I think that would be a good workable definition. Okay, now in terms, what would be the next question then?
How do you figure out what's true?
Right, how do you figure out what is true? So what would be the method by which spectrum of what I want to take up and see, you know, the angle, not that there should be the angle or any type of a spin on truth, but you always have to have a framework in terms of what discussion and what the objectives are. So I'll ask you a few questions, and you can pick the ones that seem to appeal to you. The questions that follow would be, if sciences follow reason, should religion be different? Okay. Number 2, if only one type of man exists, does multiple religions make sense? When I say one type of man, is that if we look at things are going to be common through every single individual. Everybody enjoys love, greater success than less monetary success. Just like the physical design is identical and every all those faculties exist. Now, you will have people that are taller than others, but those are only quantitative alterations within the exact same category. So in the category of height, whichever human, but that is not an essential difference. That's an accidental difference. So when saying that humans are the same, we're talking about essential qualities. So again, the second question is, If there's only one type of man, does multiple religions make sense? That's number two. Is there a method for determining God's will for mankind? And again, that's predicated on the fact that we accept that there is God, that we have a conviction of that. And that, of course, will be the first thing we take up, and then we'll move from there. Four, is blind faith a virtue? Meaning, is that a good? Is blind faith a good? Another question. And also, what is faith? Can we define what faith is? And let's see if it has any place in terms of religion. The questions, maybe we take them in order, starting with, if sciences follow reason, should religion be different? And when I say that science follows reason, we would never expect a scientist to come into the laboratory one day and tell his colleagues, well, I feel that this theory is true, without any experimentation and repeated observation of the exact same causes and effects. No scientist would claim that this is a law, it's a reality. So science works that way in every single area, paleontology and biology and astrophysics, any single area that we are studying creation, see that it follows proof, it follows the laws of reason. Now, should this apply equally to religion or not? So let's start with that question.
To find out the truth of a particular area, like gravity or physics or molecular biology or whatever, that we would follow that same approach if we're trying to find out the truth about our relationship with God and man.
Okay.
So again, I can't think of another approach that we use in society to find out the truth about something that doesn't involve logic and reason and deduction and evidence.
Okay, so reason will apply in every area then. And if we don't use reason and we just blindly accept it, so we do not know then if what we mean, faith and religion. We definitely will address that shortly, Rita, but we'll have to define what we mean by faith first, of course. But for now, as Doug is saying, we're positing that in any area, whether it's science or religion, it should not matter. And even though the most of the world at large, you'll ask them when it comes to religion, they do claim that just having faith is a great thing. Now let's just examine that for a minute. Established on blind faith. The reason being, of course, is that any type of verification of their claims is non-existent. So in order to have a system that's going to be sustained through generations, they have to come up with some sort of a formula, which is the substratum upon which all of... So what exactly is faith?
In that realm, is it the belief of something I can't prove, but I have some strong inclination to believe?
Right. Exactly. Faith is when a person does not have any proof. It could be that a person has faith in a very essential concept. He has faith in the creation of the universe, or a person could have conviction in the creation by using proofs. Again, you don't have to be at an event in order to have necessarily, although it does address events, but science also relegates itself and addresses interactions between objects or behavior of objects. Now, when we come to faith, what we're saying is that even though we're bereft of any type of proof, we will accept something, whatever it is. So that's what we call faith. Now, why do you think many religions have this concept of, besides the fact that those religions do not have any proof, and that's why they're built on faith, but what is the appeal? There still must be some appeal of faith, and that would explain the attraction of so many adherents. Steve from St. Louis is making a statement that the Bible says says faith is the hope we have without seeing the objective of that hope. That's correct. That's true. But that, again, Steve, is based on already previously verified phenomena. And that's, again, the reason of people And the event itself is something which is not subject to doubt, because the event itself was simple phenomena. As Rebbe Chaya explained in the class years ago, when you have, again, whenever you try to prove any event in history, and you'll see that, you know, proving Caesar, or proving that Alexander existed, or the Tsars, or the Vikings, or whatever group in history, which nobody alive today, and nobody's great-great-grandfathers alive today, witnessed it, yet we still accept these accounts of secular history as being 100% accurate. And the reason why we accept them is because they have two ingredients. There are masses that were at the event, and the phenomena that was observed was easily apprehended by your average person. For example, everybody would agree to John F. Kennedy's death being due to a bullet and not a bow and arrow. But if you ask these very same people that have this 100% conviction, what angle did the bullet enter his head and what angle did it exit, and did it exit, then they won't be able to tell you, because that's not within the realm of perceivable phenomena by the typical observer. But Sinai is not based on that. Sinai is based on the fact that people saw a mountain that was on fire, so people know what a mountain is, people know what fire is, and then they heard intelligent words emanating from the fire. Now, there's a reason why that event was constructed in that way. Again, God is, we can see a certain amount with our limited reason. And one of the reasons why it was constructed in this manner was that if you're going to prove that there is a being that is intelligent and not of this world, so there's only one element that you can use on earth that would refute that the source of the intelligent words that they heard is not biological, and that element is fire. There are biological organisms that exist, but not one biological organism can remain alive when it comes in contact with fire. So God chose fire as a means to display that the source of the intelligent sounds that they heard, whatever the sounds were, was an intelligence, and that's why they were afraid. If it was just a roaring animal or something of that nature, they would not have said that they feel that their souls are going to leave them. And again, this is all documented and passed down with no break in the transmission, which is unlike, for example, Christianity. We were talking yesterday in class that there may be 100 to 200 years after the existence of Jesus that the disciples and his followers committed to writing certain accounts which they claim were true. Now, if it was true that he fed 5,000 people with two fish and a couple loaves of bread, whatever it was, so such an event would be transmitted from that point forward with no break in time. The very fact that there is a recording of a supposed event hundreds of years after, and this event is miraculously witnessed by thousands of people, but the fact that there is no transmission from the supposed time and forward shows that there is a break, and this break refutes the story as being true. Okay, in terms of, for example, if we take the history of Caesar, we do not find that there was any type of break in the transmission. And I'm not talking about a break in terms of when something was written, because you could have, when Josephus wrote down something, it could have been later after the event, but the verbal transmission, there was no break, and that is something which we know. And this applies to any event in history. Okay, he was just making a comment that the scriptures were written before the temple's destruction. Okay, I'm not sure what you're getting at with that. Being resurrected, it is a myth put out to support the religion, unlike the stories in the Torah, which we have proof. Correct. Right, in terms of resurrection as well. So we see that there is a great disparity between the basis of Judaism and other religions. If you take a look at Islam, for example, you look at the flag and you notice it has a crescent moon and a star. That's because the origins of Islam were idolatrous beliefs about the powers of the moon and the stars and the sun. I believe that there was intercourse between either the sun and the moon, and they gave birth to stars, and the flag actually carries that over. So again, when people don't have, like you were saying, Doug, when there is no proof, so then belief becomes the tool by which they can, the crutch that they lean on. Okay. And again, getting back to faith, the concept of what faith is when there is no proof, like you're saying, Doug, but a person will feel this devotion towards a system. And I want to make a very strong point here. People feel that there is such a thing in the world as Christians and Jews and Muslims and so on and so forth. But that is not true. God did not create Christians or Jews or Muslims. All right? What he created was man and woman. And that was it. What people deviated later on, as Maimonides talks about in his first chapter on the laws of idolatry, you'll see how they first believed in God, but then the way we have to worship God is by worshiping those stars in the heavens and spheres in the heavens that they said, quote-unquote, minister before God. So because of the physical proximity, they assumed God was in the heavens, and therefore the stars that they saw in the heavens, they felt had a closer proximity to God than they do. So the stars and the spheres, them, just like a person will pay honor to the viceroy of the king. So that was the first mistake. And they deviated further and further till they got to the point where even God was forgotten. And they just felt all there is this star or this sphere, and that was it. And God was completely forgotten until, as Maimonides says, until the pillar of the world, Abraham, came and himself emancipated himself from idolatry, and using his mind alone was able to discern, based on proofs, that there has to be a creator. And then he taught the world, and he had tens of thousands of followers. So again, the first point that we're making is that just like science and every one tool, and that's called reason, that equally must apply to religion in terms of our life, which is God. And according to Judaism, of course, every area of our life, whether we're Jewish or Gentile, it should be that all our actions are devoted towards what our one mission is. Whether it's sleeping enough so we can have time and strength to study Torah the next day, eating properly, taking care of our health. Okay. So let me just pause here for 1 second and see if there's any questions before we move on to the next
question. Abraham, tens of thousands of followers, and I had a question. What has happened to those followers, and you know, what continuity do we have? Just like with, there was the supposed 5,000 people or 10,000 people that got fed by fish, yet we never hear tale from them or any other written evidence of it. Where else is there the evidence of all of the followers of Abraham? And part of what brings that to mind is, you know, as Noahites, the others, you know, what's to keep the current crop, so to speak, intact if you don't have something to hold you together? And you know, when Abraham was gone, they just kind of disappeared.
How do you know they disappeared?
Well, I don't. I'm wondering, I'm asking, you know, we don't have anything in our writings where we know what happened to them or what became of them, or,
but we're not,
I'm
presenting.
Curious, I guess I'm asking what became of them.
I don't know further for you, though. But again, keep in mind, that is not something which supports the veracity of Torah. We are basing...
Well, I realize that.
Okay.
I guess it's more of a selfish question in the sense that, you know, once their that group lost their leader, they just kind of disappeared.
Well, again, the group
as parents of Noahites, you become concerned what's going to happen with your children in the sense of you're surrounded by the sea of. Of, you know, what else is out there, primarily Christians, and will it be a similar fate?
Well, we do have a promise allegiance to the Torah system and follow the education. So again, so we see the clear distinction that, you know, what Judaism possesses over others. And again, that is what we have to start with, just to our mind, because again, The mind is the one element that humans have over all of creation, which clearly shows the intent of the Creator that we use it. And the Torah is replete with numerous statements from God and from Moses telling the people, don't forget what your eyes saw, and you should know it today. So many instances, the basis of the event of Sinai is requested of people to recall the proof and not to have any belief. So the Torah itself is of that nature. And just parenthetically, I think, Brad, you had sent in the list of sources in Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. God says he's going to create a new covenant. So does this mean that there's going to be an abandonment of the Torah? Well, we have to realize that that has to be couched in the full context of Torah. And God's words are that you should not add or subtract to the Torah. So he's never going to change the actual text of the Torah. When it talks about a new covenant, it means to say that the agreement he made with the Jews and that they accepted at Sinai was now going to be, and he explains there, and give them the Torah written on their hearts. It's going to be more embraced. That's what it means by a new covenant, meaning the covenant of the Torah. And the rabbis talk about it. And again, you know, we can't rely on people outside of the line of transmission, meaning Bible scholars or commentators or critics or Christians or whatever, to come and tell the Jew who has the transmission back to Moses what exactly the truth is of what we have. I would not venture to go to Henry Ford and tell him, nope, he didn't really make a Ford. I made the Ford. I can't come after the fact and make a claim to something dating back to Moses when it was given at Sinai. And in it, we have the explanations of what these terms mean and certain cryptic phrases, what the interpretations are. So this is where the authoritative view comes from, not from outside. So that's important. Okay. So we've answered the first question, which is, of course, the objective of religions, and that is to have to seek the truth in terms of man's as being 100% true, do not depend on our visual witnessing of those events. So similarly, we accept the entire rule of Caesar, that his name was Caesar, that the years of his reign were accurate. But question this as being false because the entire world has transmitted this. There is one account unanimously transmitted. Similarly, when it comes to religion, we're not discussing anything different. We are discussing an event in terms of Judaism. Other religions are not basing themselves on event, but on what one person says. So therefore, if Jesus says something to some people, or Islam has a view where Muhammad said something, so they have unbelief because there is no verifiable evidence to... Okay. And again, we have to be consistent. Then if we use intelligence in terms of science, religion is not something that takes a back seat. Our minds do not just blank out and have this blind faith or devotion. The reason why the other religions do is because there is a feeling, and certainly that's a greater thing, and I'm sure you've heard this before, that faith is better than proof. Now, why do you think faith is better than proof in the opinions of these people? Let's just try to understand this before we move forward. Touched on that earlier. But let's see, the more we can understand about what the operations of the mind in others, so this helps us to clarify what is true. So removing falsehoods is what also assists us in seeing what can be exclusively true.
Right?
Yes.
Could it be that it's a motivating factor to continue with the belief?
Well, they had to start with the belief to begin with. So what got them to phase one? You're talking about a continuation, if I understand you.
Right.
If you don't need to give a reasonable explanation, and you can answer everything. Well, in fact, you're not answering anything, Razora. What you're doing is you're giving a response to people. And there is something which is very ironic, and it's this. It's that Christianity contradicts itself. It claims blind faith, yet it attempts to use reason to interpret the Torah verses in support for their beliefs. Again, Christianity contradicts itself because it claims blind faith, Yet, it attempts to use reason to interpret Torah verses in support for their beliefs. But why use reason at all? If faith is all that is required, their Torah interpretations contradict the very credo of faith. And if a Christian would attempt to answer this question that I'm posing to you now, that would be a clear contradiction again. The attempt to answer and to give responses is really an act of reasoning. So if a Christian, doesn't matter who, if a person claims faith, and then when you ask them questions on it, and then they respond to you, that is a contradiction. As soon as they open their mouth, they don't even have to make a sound. If they are attempting to respond, that means that they are now subjugating themselves to a question and answer dialogue. That comes under the category of reason. So the actual attempts of interpreting Torah verses are a contradiction that they should just have faith. So that's an important observation.
Rabbi, it seems that faith implying devotion, which implies emotion, and there's so much in our modern society that's like, if it's important to me and if it feels good to me, then that's the most important thing, and I don't have to have any reason to feel the way I do, might factor into that?
Well, if what they're following feels good, yes. But I think there's more to it. I think that a person, when they are faithful to something without any proof, and they have this baseless devotion, there is an assumption that I am doing something fantastic here. I don't even have to. And that's actually a verse in the Torah. The Torah says that if a person says, Ki b'shriris libi eilech, that I I'm going to just go in the counsels, the freeness of my heart, and whatever my heart tells me, that must be true. Well, I mean, I doubt a person who says that would do any operation on themselves if they felt that that was, you know, their feeling. They would definitely trust the doctor, because when it comes down to it, they really are not so committed to that view. They say it because they want the freedom to be able to abandon a system which to them is restrictive.
Exactly. That's, you articulated it far better than I did.
Okay. So, yes, the person happy the way I am. I doubt very much that person would say the same thing if I could show them what they were doing was eating something poisonous. Because the person overestimates the body and does not look at the soul as being something which is eternal and the real them. Which is, again, another basic misconception that people are really just not even conscious of. If you show it to them, I think people will be able to see that. But there is an underpinning in many human beings that whatever feels good, do it. But if they were told that they had to have an operation that was very painful, but it would save their life, they would do it. They would undergo the operation. It's just that when there are restrictions imposed upon their daily activities, now I can't eat anything that I really liked anymore, and now one day a week I have to restrict my activities. I don't want that. I want to go shopping on the weekends. I mean, these are the responses that people have. I want to be able to go to the movies. This is what they have prioritized their lives as opposed to realizing that they're mortal, that they have a temporary stay on Earth, and maybe there is a will behind why they were put here. If you stop a person and ask them, did you create yourself? Well, of course, they can't say that they created themselves. And that goes to the entire mankind. So a person has to admit that there is a creator, and then the question would be, well, okay, so now that we have that realization, and there was only one event that we have where there were any witnesses of God communicating with man, and this does not exist in any other religion, where there were masses that witnessed an event where there was a voice, an intelligent voice emanating from fire. That clearly proves that the source of that voice is not biological, it's not of this world, and it was actually able to create the fire on the mountain as well. And the reason why it was done on the mountain, parenthetically, is just so this way people at a distance can see it as well, because there are 2 to 3 million people at this event, which is a very large crowd, and not everybody could be right up front at the base of the mountain. So even people who may have been, I don't know, half a mile in the distance would still be able to see this event, because the mountain is like a raised platform. That's why when you have an auditorium full of people and there's a speaker, the speaker is raised up, so this way everybody, even in the back rows, can see. That's basically why a mountain would be used. And the truth of that event is so Quran goes so far as to claim responsibility for giving Jesus to the Christians and giving Moses to the Jews and even taking the Jews through the Red Sea. If you read through the Quran, you'll see these absurdities. But their I guess, attempt is you could uncover what their motive is. It's basically functioning on the principle, if you can't beat them, not join them, but if you can't beat them, then take responsibility for them. So they wanted to have some semblance of authority, so they cannibalized the two major religions at the time, and then started distorting it with all their aggressiveness. And at Sinai, we will do and we will listen. And he wants to say that means that faith is to be preceded by action, not understanding or belief. However, that is not true, Jared, because they said Na'aseh v'nishma at Sinai, meaning they said this in connection with proof. So the proof is the basis. And again, Jerry, what you have to do is recognize what the entire Torah says and what all the, you know, from Moses to Maimonides and everybody in between, what they all say the basis of Judaism is Sinai. That is the one difference that Judaism has. It has an event that is undeniable. And in terms of what they said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and then we will hear, that means to say that they understand that the law now that comes from this creator that we know exists based on this proof, we realize this has to be a good. He created man. It's good. That's why he gave him a mouth and also gave him food. He gave him very pleasurable sensory organs. He gave him the ability to work and muscles so he can plant and reap his crops. So everything is based on a design for man's good. Okay, Jerry, I hope that clears it up. All right, let me just pause for a second, see if there's any questions before we move on. All right. Now let's go further. Again, basing Judaism on, just like we prove any event in history is true, and we don't deviate from that principle of having masses at the event, and that the event was easily apprehendable, let's just understand why those are the two ingredients. And again, I'm going to quote Rabbi Chait, who gave a fantastic, the two ingredients are mass attendees and phenomena which is easily apprehendable, is because when we want to prove that an event in history is true, we have to do is show how it's impossible to be false. Okay, again, if we want to prove any event in history as 100% true, well, if we remove all doubt, would you agree that that would now be a basis to say it's true? Doubts about any event in history, will we not arrive at a proof of its 100% truthful nature? Would that be a rational statement that I'm saying? If we remove all doubts, do we then end up with 100% proof that it's true? Is that in agreement with everybody?
Yes.
Okay, and again, if you think about it, either an event can be true or false. Is there a third possibility?
Well, you could say it's partly true, but then that would make it not completely true.
Well, either something is true or false. I mean, let me ask you a question. Can something be a third option? Either the object is in motion, the object is not in motion. Is there a third possibility?
No. One or the other.
Okay, Jane is agreeing. She says yes. Rosor as well. And Wes, good to see you again, Wes. He wants an example, okay? Well, I hope that example I just gave you in terms of reality is either present or it's not present. And you could apply this formula to anything. Either something is alive or it's dead. Is there a third option? And even if you say, well, a person's almost dead, well, he's still just as alive. It's rolling on the table so slow you can barely see it. Isn't the ball still in motion? Chaim in Chicago, again, we're not basing this on subjective perception, but we're talking when we have absolute facts in front of us. Okay, so the same thing would apply. Either something is true or it's false. We can't say something is partially true. What we mean when we say that is maybe part of your statement is true. But if a person says that I am awake right now, he's either saying the truth or he's not saying the truth. There's no third option, okay? Okay. And Grant is an anecdote. He's saying a person is either pregnant or not. Okay. An event. If we want to say an event happened or didn't, meaning either the event is true or false. Now, those are the only two options. If I can remove any possibility of its fallacy, That means to say, if I could show how it's not false, then it must be true, correct? Okay. How is an event shown to be false? Right? Either, because again, let's say we have a story in our hands. Let's take the resurrection of Jesus. All right? We have the story in our possession. The question is it true or false? So one way it could be false is if it's fabricated. Okay? Is there any other way for a story to be false?
If you have different versions of a story.
Okay, and Donnie just also wrote that on screen too, Cal. Thank you, Donnie. Yes, if there's okay. If there's different versions, so different versions would be under what category? One is fabrication. Fabrication is where a person maliciously distorts something, correct? Right? Fabrication is where a person maliciously, consciously distorts what he knows is true. Is that accurate?
Right.
Okay, that's what fabrication is. So fabrication is the purposeful distortion. So again, either something is done on purpose or it's not done on purpose, right? So what is the opposite of doing something on purpose?
Accidentally.
Good. Accidental distortion, which would mean what you just mentioned, ignorance. Meaning if a person misperceived what he's communicating, or if he heard it, or he didn't repeat it properly, okay? So that would be the second and only other possibility that a story would be reaching us that is really false. Either it was purposefully corrupted, which is purposefully distorted, or it was accidentally distorted.
Okay. Rabbi?
Yes.
Could that be a situation where the story was told in a way to illustrate a point? Let's say the people who originally told the story that Jesus walked on water, they didn't mean that he walked on water, but they wanted to prove a point. But today it is, because of distortion, taken as he actually did walk on water.
Yeah, it could be. It could be that's how it happened. But again, without any witnesses, we don't accept any story. It doesn't matter. And again, it's very important to understand this, that we do not accept a story because masses repeat it. That is not what we're saying in Judaism. We're saying that we accept a story because there is an unbroken chain of transmission. And that chain has always been masses from the moment of inception through now. Okay, just because many people reiterate a story, that in no way validates a story, and the proof is all the other religions. And you ask them to prove it, ask every one of however many there are to prove what they're repeating, and they can't. So you see very clearly that we do not accept something because masses say it. If masses told us today that 2 + 2 = 5, it doesn't matter if the entire world said it. We know with our minds that it's false. 2 + 2 can't be 5. Okay, so we have, like Grant is saying, we have ignorant or deliberate untruths. Okay? Now, if we could remove that from any story, let's take Caesar. If we could remove these possibilities of that story being false, then we have to end up with a true story. So how do we remove the possibility of fabrication? Well, what causes, how could you get fabrication? If I went to a baseball game, let's say we had a Subway Series playing the Yankees, and I go to the stadium right after the game has concluded, and in reality, the Mets had won. So now I ask the first person who comes out of the stadium, who won? Well, he tells me the Yankees. Now, do I say for sure that I bet my bottom dollar that the Yankees won? Based on one person's testimony?
No.
No. Let's say I ask 10 people who won. Those 10 people tell me the Yankees. Do I bet my $1 million in the bank that the Yankees won? Let's say I ask all 70,000 people at the stadium, and they tell me that the Yankees won. Now what do I have to say?
Pretty hard to refute.
You can't refute it. Why? Meaning to say, the person who told me the Mets really won must have been the one that was lying. And now when I have 70,000 people that are telling me the exact same story, is it possible that 70,000 people can get together and decide to fabricate a story?
Virtually impossible.
Right. Why not? Why can't 70,000 people lie about something?
Well, you can get a small group in a conspiracy to lie about something, but the larger the group, pretty soon you introduce the possibility somebody's going to snitch, somebody's going to not keep it under their hat, leak it to the local reporter, whatever, and to somehow get around and get 70,000 people to all agree to say something false, it's just not possible.
I agree practically. Give me a rule now. What is the...
The larger the group of witnesses, the more I can rely on the accuracy of their report.
Okay. And I'm going to answer Steve from Side restating it. No, that's not what we're saying, Steve. Just listen up. You'll hear. You'll hear what the distinction is. You have masses. What you are removing is the individual quality of motive that might have some motive to sustain a false story. But you cannot get tens of thousands of people to share a common motive. That is against human nature. Okay? He says, respectfully, direct witnesses are all gone, so I submit that at this time, regarding both Old Testament and New Testament miracles, both Old and New Testament miracles, we must depend on multiples of believers transmitting what they believe actually happened. No, again, we are not depending on the transmission alone. There has to be a transmission that's based on an original, the inceptional event has to be witnessed by masses. Okay, Wes? That you do not... These are facts. This is not something I'm suggesting. These are the facts, and you could research this. And you should research it, because that's the only way that we actually become convinced is when we actually answer our own doubts. So again, so the first thing we can remove from the story of Caesar is that it could not possibly have been fabricated because of the masses that witnessed his existence, the era of his reign, all the events that took place. Is that something satisfactory?
Yes.
Okay, so once we have masses at an event, we know that the prospect of fabrication is not a reality. Okay, because you cannot have masses of people with a common motive and to be certain of a truthful outcome. Well, I can't put an exact number, Warren, but I would definitely say when you have 70,000 people, that certainly, if you have 50,000, 20,000 people, certainly you will not be able to get that many people. You want to get a dozen people to fabricate something, that you definitely can't have. There are definitely conspiracies in history, but they were not proliferated by large numbers. Okay, that's a good thing, Wes. That's exactly what we're trying to do here, is to expose what the issues are and finally come to some real conviction. And again, the main part of our minds that likes to have an escape hatch, where as long as I don't prove it to myself, I still have that freedom to act out and to sin and so on and so forth. And actually the rabbis say that a person never sins unless there's some sort of a spirit of foolishness that overcomes him. It means a feeling, a certain feeling of a denial of truth. That's the only way a person could sin. Okay, so now that we see that when you have masses, ability of ignorance from the story of Caesar, okay? And let me just see the notes on the screen. Three things that a person can't do if he's... So, we have masses, so we remove any type of individual motivations, because when you have masses, it's not an individual claim anymore. And Jethro, I'll get to your point in a second. Jethro, I guess it's Jack, is saying, what are the intention of these miracles to begin with? I guess you mean Sinai, Jethro. You mean Sinai with your question? Okay, while you're doing that, let's take this. Now, to remove the second and last possibility that a story is not true, that we have today, is to remove any type of possibility that there was ignorance about Caesar.
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you're getting at. Can you be more specific?
Yes, I mean, again, we're not false, then it must be true. Because, again, there's only two possibilities. Either something is true or it's false. And we said the second step is that if we could remove any possibility of a story being false, then it must be true. We're just going step by step. So we've already shown that there's only two ways that a story can be false. Either the story that we have today that we did not witness, again, we're talking about secondhand knowledge, something that was communicated to us that our eyes didn't see. There are only two ways that this story can be false. Either it was fabricated, so that means purposeful corruption, or it wasn't distorted on purpose, but there was the way from the point of the occurrence to the point of our perception of the story, there was some sort of a accidental. If we could remove the possibility, the second possibility of ignorance, so then the story must be true, because we've shown that there's masses at the event of Caesar being emperor, so therefore there's no possibility that people all lied about it. I mean, where if they did lie about it, so where's the alternate story that really is true? You tell me the whole world is silenced about who the real emperor of Rome is, and now the whole world today has been duped, and it's everybody believes unanimously it was Caesar? That's impossible. So the masses removes the possibility that people lied about it. But there's another thing. We also know that the story is true, and it was not, there's no ignorance involved, because what is there to be ignorant about? The name of the person? The location where he lived? Can any person not know what country he's standing in? And we're talking about when mass is communicated. Any person not know a simple name of his ruler? Who today in the United States doesn't know that Bush is the president? That's an impossibility. It's too simple phenomena to suggest that people got it wrong. So when the phenomena of the story, when the content of the story that's being discussed, right, and it's under scrutiny to determine if it's true, when that content is simple phenomena, then we don't say that any ignorance was involved. So that's why, in terms of the fact that whether Kennedy was shot with a bow and arrow or a bullet, that's simple phenomena. But in terms of the angle that the bullet went into his head, that is phenomena that the people didn't perceive. And that's outside the range of normal apprehension. So we can't say that a person who starts telling us this, for sure he's correct. How does he know this? Okay? So that's why we accept any story, any event in history where there are masses, number one, and when the phenomena that they're discussing is simple phenomena, so we don't say there's any reason to say that the story is not true. That's why, even though nobody alive today saw Caesar, nonetheless, everybody today would attest 100% that he is Emperor of Rome, just like we know that Bush is the President of the United States. There's no difference in our conviction. We don't have to be at the event to know it. Formula. I mean, does this make sense to everybody? Let me just stop for a moment, because we said a mouthful. Does this make sense? That if we can remove purposeful distortion and accidental distortion, then there's no other type of distortion that exists, correct?
Correct.
All right? So we've done that in connection with Caesar, and the same thing applies to Alexander the Great, and any other history that has these two ingredients must be true. Now let's apply it to Sinai, because we're saying that this is the whole basis by why we accept Judaism and we reject any other religious claims. So Sinai was an event that had, Moses tells the people, God tells the people, Hakel li asa'am, assemble for me the people. And we have all the names coming out of Egypt and the families and the children, and we have the census that was, even though it was sinful, but was taken in King David's time 400 years later. So I think there were like 4 or 5 million men at that point. So we see that they had to come from somewhere. So if we look at the actual stories that are passed down and that are attested to by the masses, and again, we're talking about simple phenomena, so we have both ingredients by Sinai. You had masses of people, and all accounts basically put it to about 2 to 3 million people. I mean, we could actually at one point try to do a count, but I mean, this is something which is not, there's no alternate view on that. So you had masses of people, so that shows there wasn't fabrication, because again, when you have masses, you're removing the individual nature of the story. One person, yes, he could lie, because he has subjective desires, and therefore he is motivated to lie. But when you have masses, so then there's no possibility. And how do we remove the possibility of maybe Sinai being something which was people were ignorant about? You tell me.
Phenomenon was simple and easily observed and heard.
Exactly. The phenomena was simply and easily seen and heard. Everybody knows what a mountain is. Everybody knows what fire is. Everybody knows what an intelligent sound is. There was no doubt as to what the nature of the sound was. This was the objective. This was the purpose. And to answer the question earlier, somebody asked, so what Jethro was asking, what were the purpose and all the claims of the miracles by Jesus? Well, it's clear that what they're trying to do is give his story some semblance of a biblical character, so it would have this type of a religious feel to it. And also that they would fear. People would fear somebody who could do miracles. Oh, it must be a man of God. So miracles is always something which you endow with a figure that you're trying to deify. So that's the reason why they had to project fallacy in the form of supposed miracles. Okay. And again, it should be clear that, I mean, we should get it clear in our mind, because a lot of times people feel, well, I didn't see it myself. How do I know it was really true? Well, if you accept Caesar, then you must accept Sinai. And if you don't accept Sinai, then you cannot accept Caesar or any other event in history. You also can't accept that your doctor is a doctor. Were you there when he went to medical school? Did you see him do all the operations? The truth is that most of what a person lives his life is based on secondhand knowledge that he never witnessed. But since we know that there are rules of human nature, and those are true and verified. All right, now Donnie is asking a good question. He says as follows. How do you answer the episode of World War II when one man, Adolf Hitler, right, Yimach Shemo, that his name should be wiped out, that he spun a myth and convinced the nation and ultimately 6 million died? Okay, Donnie, the distinction between that and Sinai is that Hitler was not telling people that they witnessed any event. He told them that you are a Aryan race. He got them to believe a belief, not that they saw anything. That's the distinction, Donnie. So you can get people to believe. I mean, look at the entire world. It's full of religions that outnumber Jews, a million to one. I don't know that much, but belief can be something which is cherished by a person and repeated over. But you will not be able to. If Hitler went over to the people and told them you all saw an event, which they didn't, then they would think he's a lunatic. But he didn't make that mistake. He made a greater mistake. He killed 6 million Jews. And many of the 13 million altogether between Jews and Gentiles that he killed. I'm not sure the number. But that's a difference. The difference is that we are discussing witnessed events. And that cannot be something which is transmitted unless there were witnesses. But to get many, many people to believe something, that's not a problem. That does not depend on anything but a person's feelings. Let's just pause for a second and see if there's any questions. Because what I want to do now in the last part is just to show you a bit as to why these other religions came about. I mean, what exactly do they stem from? So I'll wait 1 second, see if anybody, and Doug, Cal, Brad, Mary, anybody over there, if you have questions, feel free to
speak. We're good.
Okay. All right, so now let's just understand one more thing, which I think is very important for us to understand why there are other religions. This all stems back to our infancy, our stage of being infants. See, God designed man in a way that we start out as feeble, helpless, tiny children, where we are totally dependent on authoritative figures. That, you know, the Ten Commandments, again, everything which God creates is a system and there's a precise design. The Ten Commandments are split up into two sets of five each. The first five deal with laws between man and God. The second five are between man and man. Now there's one law which in the first set, which deal with the laws between man and God, that seems to be out of place. And that is the law, the fifth of honoring the parents. Honoring the parents sounds like a law between man and man. However, if we study it, we see that the reason why we have this obligation of honoring our parents and why God created us as infants is God wanted to develop a certain sense of authority, a respect of authority in us that would eventually be transposed onto God. If we were created complete and whole, say we didn't have direction in life, so we would have just come onto the world stage as completely independent, self-sufficient beings without anybody else, that would have conflicted with God's objective that we subjugate ourselves to him as an authority. So in order to pave the way for man to have the first step necessary to learn about God, it was necessary that there's a fear of God. So therefore, he creates humans as dependent beings, where we are, for the first 10, 15, almost 20 years of our life, we are underneath the thumb of our parents, and we look at them, and they pick us up, and they feed us, and they take care of us, and we have a tremendous fear and respect. Eventually, we become adults, but for many, made it into us and imbued into us this feeling of a respect for an authority figure. Eventually, we are supposed to transpose that onto God. This is why the laws of honoring the parents is in the first set of laws, the first set of the Ten Commandments, which deal with between man and God, because that's really what the law of honoring parents targets in the long range. But there's also other facets to that experience of being dependent infants. See, what happens is, there's two paths a person can take when they mature and realize that they can provide for themselves just like their parent. One path, which is the proper path, is to recognize that their parents are not any different than they are. And they themselves soon will be a parent. So the person should shed that superhuman view that they had of the parents and realize, no, parents are just like me. And then they mature and they recognize that there's really only God. But what many, many people do, and this is where the false religions have their seeds and where their infancy from, is that the people that could not abandon this need for the parent, when they got older, now they saw that they realized the truth also. My parents are no different than me. They are no more powerful than me. Now they felt a tremendous void in their life, and they could not abandon the need for some sort of a parental human figure. And you'll notice that many, many idols are in the form of man or animal or a combination of the two, because that's the imprint that is on our psyche from youth, is that the authority figure, the one that I fear, is a humanoid form. So what these people do that just cannot extricate themselves from this type of an infantile state, so what they do is they create new forms of the parent. And that is what idolatry is. Idolatry is nothing more than the need for the parent that has now become embodied in a manufactured form. And it has a very strong appeal, so therefore has very many adherents. And it's no question why Christianity has such appeal, because it's the primary figure is human. So it's important that we understand where it comes from, because really what God wants is for a person to develop his life not into an emotional framework and to remain in the infantile state, but that he should abandon that and recognize there's only one creator for all humans, and that to live his life based on principle, based on truths, on ideas, on what's provable. And this again is really where the mark of distinction of Judaism over every other religion is. It's based on provable phenomena. It's based on following reason. That is why we have the intellect. As Rabbi Chaid explained once very nicely, the intellect is called Tselem Elokim. Like Tselem means like a form, a similitude. And Elohim means God, so a similitude of God. God gave the name of our intellect. He put into Hebrew equivalent of intellect, he put his own name, Tselem Elohim. Why? Because he wanted to emphasize to man how important this faculty is. This is the one faculty that you should not overlook and that you should use in every single area of your life. It's so important. And that is really the only method by which a person will arrive at truth and what's real and not fool himself. A person wants to just have faith and to have these feelings of devotion, they're going to do it. But a person has reason, and you can't penetrate any person. They have that sense. I mean, maybe I'm speaking too soon, I'm not sure, but if a person could see reason in one part of their life, there could be a bridge how you could show them that even in religion, reason has to be applied. And it's not an area where you just take a back seat. I mean, we do see businessmen that are fantastic and they're successful, but then the same day they'll open up the horoscope page. Again, there's a dichotomy in the mind in terms of using rational approach to making money, but when it comes to other areas, their mind shuts off. But if they, if there is some semblance of reason being used by an individual, there is hope that they could now transfer that over to the area of religion, because now we understand why they're following this way. I mean, it shows us an alternative explanation. It's not because there's any truth of people doing something. There can be many reasons behind it. But don't confuse masses of people doing something or saying something with masses of people who witnessed an event. That only Judaism has. Okay. Let's pause here and see if there's any questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
The topic of assuming responsibility to me seems to fit in here too, because the infantile mind per se, the parents are responsible for the child, but then as you let go of the parent, then the child that's becoming an adult needs to assume responsibility, and it seems like Judaism is the only religion that demands that the person take responsibility.
That's true. I mean, Christian, God says, do not add and do not subtract to my words. Okay, so number one, there's no new covenant the way they explain it, that now God's abrogating his previous law. But number two, the Torah says openly that each man will die in his own sin. And Christianity denies that and says, no, Jesus is going to die for everybody else's. Meaning, to your point, the responsibility, but coupled with that, is the fact that openly there's a complete denial of God's word. But they, again, didn't have the knowledge of the Torah when they're writing it. They wrote things down that they felt sound really good. And what can get us a big audience? And what's going to attract a lot of adherents in the future? That's the, what do we do about this from Isaiah? He's quoting Isaiah 9:5, quote, for a child is born unto us, a son is given unto us, and the government holder, and his name is called Pele Joel El Gibor. I'm not sure what your question is there, Wes. I'm not sure. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. All right, so I think we'll wrap it up here. Is to really understand that, again, we also said that there's only one type of human being. So it does not make sense that there should be more than one type of religion. The color of the skin and height and accents, one system is appropriate for something to that, but that does not validate whatever a person believes. And we also said that masses that follow something is not itself any type of a proof, just like the masses that Hitler convinced, and that's up to everybody to really look. Okay, Wes, I'll have to take a look at that. Wes is just quoting something on screen. I'm not sure what that is. I'll have to look at that, and I'll get back to you. So if you want to just pop an email to me, we'll take care of that. We also showed about idolatry, where the seeds of idolatry started. And it's really nothing more than just infantile emotions seeking a parent figure. That's all it is. And I think it would be helpful, actually, for everybody who's listening. There's a book by Sadia Gaon. It's called The Book of Beliefs and Opinions. And in it, he exposes all the methods by which some blood. But it doesn't mean they made blood. They made something red. They had red dyes that they used, that they concealed in their hands, and people weren't looking, they would throw it into the water. And how did they get the frogs to jump out of the chemicals again that they knew that frogs were allergic to? They were able to this morning. How come it was that the Egyptians could not preserve all of the grains in the granaries like Joseph did? They came to Paro and they said that we're trying to preserve all the grain because we know the 7 years of famine are coming, but we can't do it. But Joseph was successful. So where were all the magicians then when it came to preserving grain? So the answer is that when it came to being magical and doing beautiful feats and tricking people, that they spent all the time rehearsing, playing with animals and frogs and blood, all these things they had rehearsed, and they knew how to use sleight of hand. But they never experienced famine. They had plenty all the time because the Nile River was always rose and gave them all their sustenance. So since they never had any experience with a famine, they never ever thought to preserve grain. So since they never had that situation confronting them, so they never had the chance to experiment to see how to preserve grain. So that's why they couldn't do it. There's no magicians. There's no such thing as magic. Right? It just, you look at the phenomena, you see why certain things they were able to do, because they used sleight of hand. And they even said when Moses did the miracle of the lice, then they said to Paro, oh, this is the finger of God, meaning they copped out. They're saying, now they said God exists. Yeah, because they couldn't do it. Because lice are so small, the hand cannot manipulate things that are too small. That's why they couldn't duplicate what Moses was doing, since everything was sleight of hand. So then they said, oh, this must be God, in order that they didn't have to bear any shame for their, they were incapacitated. And actually, a friend of mine's daughter asked me yesterday, a 10-year-old girl, and it's interesting, she's learning in yeshiva, she's learning in school the area where it says that machshev lo zechaya, which means that a witch you should not let live. And it doesn't just mean a witch, it means a warlock too. But they just mention witch because I guess in those times, or maybe even now, that the susceptibility to superstition is something which was more of a female quality. Probably because since man is really the one who's more physically capable, he's working the fields, his life is more practically oriented. So since he's so involved in the practical, he doesn't have opportunity for his mind to escape into superstition. But somebody who's not involved in the practical, so then there is that opportunity. It doesn't mean that man is any less apt to do it. It's just that since the time precluded him from letting his mind go astray, and he was forced to think of practical ways of irrigation and planting, so therefore his mind didn't escape as quickly into superstition. So the Torah formulated it in terms of what the majority of cases was, not because there's any that the Torah blames him psyche. I mean, there are definitely differences, but the Torah says it's only mentioning the common case. But what does it mean? So the girl asked me, well, because we were discussing this idea, that if there's no magic, how can the Torah say that you shouldn't let a witch live? So I told her that it doesn't mean that she's a real witch. It just means that she's doing things to fool people that she's a witch. And somebody who does that then obscures God from being the only and exclusive source of any power in the world. That's why it's such a severe penalty. Or if people lead other people astray to other religions, they're killed. Meaning to say that since the objective of life is to use our intelligence to arrive at knowledge of God, any individual who tries to thwart that pristine goal is completely defiant of God's ultimate will, and therefore they have existence, so they don't cause anybody else to go astray. But throughout, I mean, it's a good book, the Book of Beliefs and Opinions by Sadia Gaon, and he exposes and he talks about how these things are just foolish, and that people believe that there's any magic. Nobody has powers. We're individuals that have limited capabilities, and we basically top out at being able to lift a certain amount of weight. That's about all we can do. We can move objects from here to there. We could jump only so high. There's a very limited scope of physical activity that we have. Certainly, we cannot start changing laws that existed before we existed. So man cannot, the concept of magic should be completely put to rest. It's just from reason, and you see the rabbi spoke about it. Right, so any questions before we log off?
Rabbi?
Yes.
The title, book again?
It's called The Book of Beliefs and Opinions by Sadia Gaon. His name is S-A-A-D-I-A, and his last name is G-A-O-N. Sadia Gaon.
Thank you.
Okay.
Rabbi, thanks very much.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure. Let me just tell you, it's published by Yale Judaica Series, the press, in New Haven or London. It's a really good book. It's a little getting used to because he is using strict rational approaches. He'll give you 24 arguments for this and 17 arguments for that, but he's good. He does not just say something, and that would be a quick way to search it. Probably you can get it on Amazon. ISBN number is 0-300-04490-9. That's 0-300-04490-9. And of course, the other very important book to get would be Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed. And Dover puts that out. And both of them are in English.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, so I guess we're going to resume Sunday, and Cal said she wanted to keep on going on this theme, so you just let me know during the week. Next, and I invite everybody else to join us then, too. The next class will be this coming Sunday at 11:15 a.m. That's New York time.
Okay, 8:15 Pacific.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Rabbi. We really appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a great day to everybody.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Be well.